This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 29th of May, these are our main stories. Threats of water shortages as India's capital Delhi breaks the all-time heat record and the country swelters. A senior Israeli official says he expects the fighting to continue in Gaza for at least the rest of the year. How North Korea is menacing its southern neighbour with balloons filled with rubbish. As voters in South Africa go to the polls, President Cyril Ramaphosa believes support for his party is solid. Also in this podcast...
This is some white blackmail.
I'm going to post it all over the internet.
The Nigerian criminals using nude photos to extort money from young people around the world. In India, there are warnings of water shortages after officials there recorded the highest ever temperature for the capital Delhi at 52.3 degrees Celsius, shattering the record set just 24 hours earlier. India is, of course, no stranger to searing summer temperatures, but climate change is making heat waves longer, more frequent and more intense. The heat wave was also smashing records across other parts of the country, with the extreme heat taking its toll on everyone, including relatively fit young students who were rushed to hospital after collapsing at a school in Bihar. This doctor said the extreme heat wave was making them ill.
The students are facing difficulties because of the extreme heat and rising temperatures. There's an electrolyte imbalance in their bodies, which is making them feel faint or vomit or feel dizzy.
To understand what it's like to live in such conditions, I've been speaking to our correspondent in Delhi, Raghvendra Rao.
It's getting very, very unbearable for the people of Delhi and for the people of North and Central India in general. And, you know, this is the kind of heat which has not been witnessed in India before. And many people are already feeling very apprehensive as to what they are in store for.
Well, you're there. You're in Delhi. I mean, tell us what it's like trying to cope with this kind of heat.
Well, it's very difficult to operate in such high temperatures. I mean, people are finding it extremely difficult to carry out their day to day lives. In fact, many schools in this part of the country and in the north of India, they have discontinued classes. In fact, they have moved to online teaching for a few days because you cannot expect children to be going out to schools in such harsh weather. In fact, many private companies are also said to be mulling options of allowing their employees the option of working from home. It's getting very, very difficult for people just to step out of their homes and, you know, do their normal jobs or attend to their normal responsibilities. So, yes, I mean, very horrible conditions there. And it's something which people are finding it very, very difficult to deal with.
I mean, is it difficult to breathe in that kind of heat? Are you hit by a wall of heat?
Well, absolutely. And, we are already witnessing cases of people getting heat strokes. The authorities are issuing advisories. They are asking people not to venture out in these hot climates. And they are, in fact, advising people to take as much liquids as they can. And all kinds of advisories are being issued. People are, in fact, being encouraged not to venture out at all.
Raghvendra Rao in Delhi. Well, several parts of Asia have been grappling with unusually high temperatures this year, a trend scientists say has been worsened by climate change.
4, 3, 2.
Now a joint European-Japanese satellite that will measure how clouds affect climate has successfully made it into orbit. The EarthCare satellite blasted off on Elon Musk's SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket from the Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. Computer modelling suggests that cloud cover could actually decrease in the future, amplifying global warming by allowing the Earth to absorb more energy from the sun. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos was watching liftoff and spoke to Alex Ritson.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mission, Alex. It's going after one of the great uncertainties in climate prediction. You know, our computer models are really good at trying to tell us about what will happen into the future if we continue to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But there are a few things that we're really quite uncertain about. And one of those is the behavior of clouds, the role clouds will have in influencing the climate as we go forward. If you look at clouds, some of the low-level clouds, those big fluffy clouds down near the surface of the Earth, they help cool the planet. The sun's radiation comes in, it bounces off the top of them, and it goes back out into space. But some of the high-level clouds, these high cirrus clouds, they act as a blanket. They trap heat, and they help warm the climate. And so the key for the computer models, for the climate scientists, is to work out where the balance is and how that might change as more greenhouse gases are put into the atmosphere. And EarthCare is the tool that they're going to use to try and work that out.
Yeah, and though this was launched by an Elon Musk SpaceX rocket, this is actually led by the European Space Agency.
Yeah, there's a long story there. I mean, it was supposed to go up on a Russian rocket, and then they had the Ukraine war, and so Europe stopped using Russian rockets. They were going to use a European rocket, but then that had a failure. And so they rang up Mr. Musk and said, actually, can you help us? And he's given them one of his rockets. Well, obviously, he's sold it to them to put this EarthCare mission into space. It's been a long time coming. The first concept was dreamt up 30 years ago, 31 years ago. Can you believe that? The mission was approved 20 years ago, and only now is it in orbit, because they've had enormous technical challenges developing the instruments that will get this information for them. So it's got a space laser that fires down through the atmosphere. That's going to look at the tops of the clouds. It'll see all the very fine dust particles and what we call aerosols, droplets in the atmosphere, around which clouds, water vapor can condense and make clouds. But it'll also look with a radar inside the clouds, so they'll know how much water is in those clouds, the updrafts and the downdrafts. They'll get a really good idea of how clouds form and evolve through time.
Jonathan Amos. A senior Israeli official says he expects fighting to continue in Gaza for at least the rest of this year. The Prime Minister's National Security Advisor, Zaki Hanegbi, also says Israel's military now controls three-quarters of the buffer zone along the Gaza-Egypt border. From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yoran Nel reports.
The idea that the Gaza war could go on for at least another 7 months will worry many in Israel and outside. There's been growing international pressure on Israeli leaders to outline a full strategy to end the fighting and a convincing post-war vision for the Palestinian territory. In his interview, Mr. Hanegbi, seen as a close confidant of the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, also suggested that Israel would soon take full control of the strategically important strip along the Gaza-Egypt border. The plan, he added, was to work with the Egyptians to prevent weapons smuggling to Palestinian armed groups. In Rafah, in southern Gaza, residents say that today there have been more Israeli airstrikes and that Israeli tanks mounted raids in the west and centre before retreating to positions on the border.
Yolan Nel. In Mexico, the presidential elections are due to be held on Sunday, and one of the main concerns raised during the campaign is the situation at the border with the US. Every day, thousands of Mexicans illegally cross the border into America, often in extremely treacherous conditions. The BBC's James Reynolds has been to the Californian desert to hear about the tragic fate of one of the migrants.
This is the border area between Mexico and the United States. And if you look on a map, you'll see that the border between the two countries extends for, what, about 2,000 miles, 3,000 kilometres, and there are cities along the American side. But it is only when you get here, when you stand right here in the desert, under the sun, almost all alone, that you realise just how dangerous it is to be trying to make this crossing. It is easy to get lost here, to run out of water, simply not to know which way to turn, confused by the shrubland, not knowing which way is Mexico and which way is the United States. And the dangers of this journey are shown by what happened here to one man. He was trying to build a life for him and his wife and his four kids. He broke his leg on the journey, and he died not far from me here in the shade of a small bridge. This border has become an election campaign point on both sides, both for Mexico and also for the United States. It will be debated and discussed as those two elections approach, the first in June and the second in November.
On this trip, in addition to my BBC colleagues, we've also been joined by a volunteer who works in this border area.
My name is Cesar Ortigosa. We usually come out to the desert twice a month, searching for people that have passed, or they are alive, but they are trying to find their way home. Usually families or family members, they called us or send a message on our Facebook page and asking for help. So once we gather enough information, we go to the area where they told us their family member might be missing.
Where are we going now?
Yeah, right now we're heading down to that bridge right there. It's right off the old Highway 8. That's where we found Jose Cervantes about 2 years ago. We found him about 15 minutes after he had passed.
What did he die of?
We aren't sure about it. Probably dehydration. He had a broken leg. And so he was able to walk all this long from the border, and he finally passed.
Right here.
Exactly right here.
And we're just underneath a very small bridge. We have to duck our heads and going underneath. And there's a little shrine to him here. There we are, Jose Federico Hernandez. And they were able to bury him in Mexico?
No, they buried him right here.
They buried him here, so he's buried in the United States.
He was buried in the United States.
You can see this border on the map, and the first thing that you do when you look on the map is you see the US on one side, Mexico on the other side. You see that the border between the two stretches for about 2,000 miles, 3,000 kilometers. You see the big cities, San Diego, El Paso, and so on. But the map doesn't tell you everything. It's only when you're standing right here in the desert that you realize just how vast this border area is and just how small human beings are in this area. I hear nothing around me. I see desert around me. I see shrubs and bushes and mountains in the distance. You can feel lost. You can feel entirely on your own here in the desert. I want to get you to listen to the sound of the desert, and you're probably not going to hear anything. And that is the entire point. Let's listen. I wonder if you heard anything apart from perhaps a slight rustle of the wind. We've heard a few insects buzzing by. We haven't heard any bird song. We haven't heard any traffic. We haven't seen any people walking by. In this desert, you can be entirely alone. And the sounds tell you that you are alone.
James Reynolds. BBC News has learned that international criminals are selling guides on social media explaining how to carry out the crime of sextortion. The guides show how to pose as a young woman online, trick victims into sending sexually explicit material, and then blackmail them. Last month, the UK National Crime Agency issued an alert to schools about a rise in cases involving children. Our correspondent Angus Crawford reports.
On the beach, drinking cognac. Living it up. Olamide Sanu, accused of making £2 million through sextortion, part of a gang tricking victims into sending nude images of themselves online and then blackmailing them. Yesterday, in court in London, facing extradition to the US.
Investigators say Olamide Sanu was involved in the sextortion of hundreds of victims, part of a new wave of gangs based mainly in Nigeria. Their aim? Terrify their targets, often children, and make them pay.
He was shell-shocked, and he was literally physically shaking.
There are scores of different gangs targeting children, children like Lucy's 14-year-old son.
Then he just came up to me and said, "Mummy, I've had this message." And he just looked terrified, worried. And I said, what is it? And he showed me his phone. It was a text message basically saying, "Don't shut us down. If you don't send us money in 24 hours, we'll send a picture to all your contacts."
Lucy closed her son's account, turned off the phone, and never heard from the gang again. Her son's fine. She's furious.
We know that some teenagers tragically have ended their own lives because of this.
If he hadn't been at home that morning, and I hadn't been in the kitchen, and he hadn't talked to me. I don't know how he would have carried on the rest of that day. You know, I don't know how it would have played out for him.
Okay.
A film made to warn young people in the US, where cases have surged. Experts warn boys are most at risk. Nigerian criminals calling themselves Yahoo Boys. It's become a global industry. DIY guides, sextortion manuals, openly for sale online.
Every Friday, usually payment.
He boasts that his victims have to pay him again and again.
This is some white blackmail.
This one takes pride in threatening people.
I'm going to post it all over the internet.
We decide to call one, see if he'll pick up, challenge him.
Hello?
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
I'm a journalist from the BBC. You're a criminal, and you're exploiting children. You're extorting them and blackmailing them. What have you got to say for yourself?
I'm really sorry about that. And I can actually assure that that won't continue.
Well, he says he won't continue, but I don't believe a word of that. He's completely untraceable, and there are hundreds, maybe thousands of men just like him carrying out sextortion.
Lucy is speaking up about her child now, to protect other people's.
If every teenager in England knew this was a possibility, hopefully very few would become prey.
That report from Angus Crawford. Still to come in this podcast.
Basically, I remix nursery rhymes and I turn them into modern-sounding main stage club anthems.
How nursery songs are being given a modern makeover. Voting is underway in South Africa in what could be the most consequential election since the historic vote back in 1994, which saw the end of the racist apartheid era and the nation's move to democracy. Nearly 28 million voters have the chance to cast their ballot. Anger over corruption scandals, soaring crime, unemployment, frequent power cuts and water shortages suggest the African National Congress, the party of the country's first democratically elected president Nelson Mandela, may lose its majority for the first time in 30 years. These voters in Soweto were clear about the issues that matter.
Education. Unemployment is high in the country. Crime is high in the country, and even if people cannot be employed after they are educated, they are able to go and work in other countries. When you have to switch on the generator, the cost of diesel has been going up, the cost of doing business has gone up.
Sometimes I think that change is good, because to be honest, I don't see ANC doing anything, personally for me, but I don't know about other people.
Nomsa Maseko watched former President Jacob Zuma cast his vote outside Durban.
There was lots of commotion and singing and ululating when his security came inside this polling station. Hundreds of his supporters have also gathered here and they've been singing and chanting his clan name. So Jacob Zuma has voted, but he is quite an important figure in this election because his political party could be kingmaker in this election, particularly in this province of KwaZulu-Natal.
I spoke to our Africa correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, who was at a polling station in Soweto.
I've just arrived at a voting station at a school in the township of Soweto, Kwansikana Junior Secondary School, and I'm shivering in the early morning cold, watching clusters of people warm themselves around small fires. I don't see the sun, do you?
I know the sun is coming, so I'm a bit at ease knowing that, you know, it's almost symbolic because this is the anxious, shaky time. We're going to vote, we're going to do all of this stuff, but, you know, the sun is coming.
Well, that sounds very hopeful.
Yeah.
And as a young man, what are your biggest concerns?
You know what happens when people get into power and corruption, but we can always think about those things as deterrents. But hope is the thing that led us to me being able to vote right now.
This voting station is in the old neighborhood of Nelson Mandela. His house is really just a five-minute walk away. And his party, the ANC, people still feel they owe it a debt of gratitude because it gave them the right to vote at the dawn of democracy in South Africa. And so for that reason, many people are still supporting it. But also, the party is losing support because of people's unhappiness with its performance in government. What's on your mind now as you're planning to cast your vote?
We are excited that there's more opportunities for new parties which have come on board. You don't want just one party ruling.
Have you voted for the ANC in the past?
I have.
Sounds like you might be giving another party an opportunity this time.
Not really.
No. Voting got off to a bit of a late start at this polling station, but people have now begun to cast their ballots.
I know my casting my vote would make a change, and I hope that God should help us.
What kind of change are you looking for?
There is a lot. Most of our children have gone into drugs. They can't get to jobs. They can't go to school. Money's not there. There's a lot.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Togoto.
And you are how old?
I'm 18.
So this is your first election?
Yes.
And how do you feel about that?
Just happy, willing to vote out some people.
And which party do you think can bring change?
Phyllis Malima, EFF.
EFF meaning the Economic Freedom Fighters, yes? So you think the ANC isn't doing a good enough job?
Yes, it has done nothing for the past 30 years.
The Economic Freedom Fighters are a breakaway party from the ANC with quite radical solutions to South Africa's economic situation. They propose nationalizing mines and expropriating land. The other breakaway party is the MK, which is backed by the former president, Jacob Zuma, and is seen as his challenge to the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa. Do you think there is an option on the ballot that can bring the change you want?
I'm going to eeny, miny, mo it, to be honest.
But you obviously feel strongly enough about the right to vote to cast your ballot.
Definitely. I do feel strongly about it. I don't know who I'm voting for, but we'll see inside.
Voting is going to continue here and throughout the country until the end of the day. And then the focus is going to shift to the outcome. In particular, how much support the ANC got, how much it lost, and how it will handle that. But whatever the case, this election marks a new era for the ANC and for South Africa.
Barbara Plett-Usher. The former Prime Minister of Thailand, Thaksin Shinawat, has been accused of insulting the monarchy, a serious charge under Thai Les Majesty laws. His comments date back to 2015, when he was in exile. He's now back in Thailand and due to appear in court in 3 weeks' time. So, why is this happening now? Here's our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
Well, it has to be political. I mean, this is Thaksin Shinawat, a very high-profile, controversial figure, still mistrusted by much of Thailand's sort of conservative establishment. It's going to be widely seen as a kind of warning, a sword that hangs over him. The case is likely to take quite a long time to come to trial. They're very slow in Thailand. And just a kind of warning not to get too ambitious. You know, when he came back last year under this grand bargain where he was pardoned, he technically was supposed to serve a jail sentence but didn't, spend a bit of time in hospital. The idea, well, he said, was that he wasn't going to be involved in politics and that he wanted to spend time with his grandchildren. Everybody knows he's the main funder and very influential in his party, which is at the core of the governing coalition. His ally, Seta Thavisin, is the prime minister. And he's become a bit more visible. He's been moving around, looking almost like a man who's campaigning. And I think there are people who just want to put that warning there.
And it really is a draconian law, isn't it? I mean, what could happen to him if found guilty?
Every Les Majesty charge has the potential for you to get a 3 to 15 year prison sentence. Typically, these are reduced by half. If you don't contest the charges, you immediately confess, which is what happens in most cases. But some people are charged on multiple counts. You know, people post something on Facebook. If the posts go out 7 times, you can end up getting 7 times that. So the record sentence we've seen so far is somebody got 50 years in prison. Remember, the comments Mr. Thaksin's alleged to have made didn't relate to the monarchy. They related to the advisory council of senior military figures that advises the king. He accused them of being complicit in the coup that ousted the administration of his sister back in 2014. He didn't actually comment on the royal family or the monarchy itself, but it's still, the courts would view, covered by the law.
And what do you think this tells us about the situation in Thailand at present?
That it's still very fluid. You know, people imagined last year when Mr. Thaksin was allowed to come back that there was this grand bargain, that the conflict that has hung over Thailand for the last 15, 20 years, where he was at the heart of it and was feared for his populist style by the old conservatives close to the palace, that that was being settled, that he was no longer such a threat, that he was older, that his party had been outflanked by this new reformist party move forward, and that that would allow a stable coalition with his party at the core of it.
Jonathan Head. North Korea has made good on its threat to send balloons across the border to South Korea in retaliation for propaganda leaflets sent into the north. South Korea's military says it's found dozens of balloons in two border provinces with plastic bags attached containing waste paper and even excrement. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton gave me the latest on the balloon wars.
As you said, just a few days ago, North Korea warned that it was going to do this. The Vice Minister of National Defense warned that there would be retaliation in return for, as you said, balloons that had been sent over from the South Korean side over into the north. These are balloons that have been sent for years and years now, despite a ban on the practice placed in 2020. South Koreans and North Korean defectors have been sending balloons carrying pamphlets, leaflets, often religious leaflets, carrying USB sticks, medicine, radios, all sorts of things. The North Koreans finally got a bit fed up with this, or I shouldn't say finally, they have been very upset about this for years. But on Sunday, they warned they were going to send balloons of their own, and that's exactly what they've done. We're now into hundreds of balloons that have been sent over from North Korea into the south. They've been found across eight of South Korea's nine provinces, carrying plastic, scraps of paper, dirt, and yes, animal excrement. So there have been lots of warnings from the South Korean military for people to stay inside and definitely stay away from the contents of these balloons.
Well, it does sound like a bit of a dirty protest. What is the current state of relations between the two Koreas?
Oh, they're just at a really low point, I would say. You know, we have seen these kinds of stunts before between the two. Back in 2020, North Korea actually blew up a liaison office that was used by the two countries that was on the North Korean side of the border, just to illustrate its displeasure with the South. Since then, we've gone on to see North Korea test a record amount of missiles. We've seen North Korea suspend a military pact between the two that was attempting to keep peace. That happened just last year. And then also end its goal of eventually reuniting with the South. And I should add that both sides, South Korea has really developed its relationships with Japan and the United States. And North Korea has really cozied up to Russia. In fact, the United States says that there's an unprecedented amount of military cooperation between North Korea and Russia. So basically, they're finding their own friends.
And North Korea's state news agency says it will send more balloons across the border. And finally, should traditional nursery rhymes such as Ba Ba Black Sheep and Humpty Dumpty get a rebrand? Well, the children's charity Youth Music questioned 500 parents and found half thought under fives would benefit from a wider choice of sounds. Even the world's biggest act for toddlers, The Wiggles, has decided it's time to shake it up with the release this week of a rave album. David Sillitoe reports on a movement to bring techno to toddlers.
The wheels on the bus go round and round.
The wheels on the bus, a toddler classic, but now a new version. The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round. Welcome to techno for toddlers.
Basically, I remix nursery rhymes and I turn them into modern sounding main stage club anthems.
Lenny Pierce is just one of a number of artists trying to widen the preschool musical diet.
My daughter is 1.5 years old, and that was my daughter's favourite song at the time, but just the normal one, The Wheels on the Bus. So I just changed it up a little bit, and it's got about almost 2 million streams in just 3 weeks, which is really, really crazy. And I've just launched a series of, like, rave shows for kids.
And he's not alone.
Ayana and her family unit.
This is Ollie Halverson, who writes bespoke songs for the under fives and their preferred musical style.
Eating meals.
Ayana and Laya, for instance, have varied tastes.
Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson.
My favourite music is Mamma Mia.
There you go, her favourite song is Mamma Mia.
And Etta and Ernie.
Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash. Yeah, you do listen to that, don't you?
Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
For anyone who thinks it's all twinkle, twinkle at this age, research by the Youth Music Charity has revealed a different picture, as their programme director, Carol Reed, explains.
Under fives are often just underestimated and kind of written off. And actually what we've seen here is that they're like the rest of us.
Is the traditional music serving families well?
The traditional music of under fives is not chiming with the modern generation. Half of the families that we spoke to said that they thought nursery rhyme lyrics needed to be updated.
I have four brothers over the sea, many, many Dixies.
Yes, nursery rhymes. Attempts to reform and rewrite them date back to the Victorian era.
Patrum, patrum, paradisi temporary,
but without much success. Three-year-old Jordan is partial to a bit of goosey-goosey. Mum's not so keen on a rhyme that's almost definitely not about geese, but rather possibly priest holes or prostitution. And the rest of the parents here have their doubts.
Children's rhymes, nursery rhymes, no. Not for me, no.
You've had it with Blah Blah Black Sheep, haven't you?
Yes.
Your least favourite.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
And for Angeline and Ollie at Groundswell, who have to sing all this stuff...
You've got a world-weary look.
There's hope that the preschool repertoire might be ripe for change.
I just think finding a range of songs from different types of genres, different languages.
The wheels on the bus go round and round.
Wheels on the bus.
I actually like that one probably even less.
So maybe Lenny and his Techno for Toddlers is onto something. Indeed, he's already had an influence on his brother's band, who happen to be global superstars of music for the under fives.
Hot potato, hot potato, hot potato, hot potato.
The Wiggles, who have just released their first preschool rave album.
That's a note to end on. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox. The producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.